Ladies and gentlemen, it's a wonderful privilege to have Carl Otto Perl to give the ninth set of Lionel Robbins memorial lectures. When you were last here, Carl Otto, I remember you said a very sweet thing, that being invited to give a lecture at the LSE was like being given a knighthood. Maybe you don't remember. So I suppose that being invited back is like being given a peerage. Anyway, of course, the honour is ours, in fact. And I'm sure everybody here knows the enormous contribution that Carl Otto has made to monetary stability in the present-day world. He was the distinguished president of the Bundesbank from 1980 to 1991. And during that period, I think that he did more than anybody else to restore monetary stability in Europe. And I think one measure of his success is that all over the world now, people are wanting to establish independent central banks like the Deutsche Bundesbank. I think that Lionel Robbins would have been really thrilled to have someone as distinguished as you to give these lectures. And it's a very great pleasure that we have Iris Robbins, Lionel's wife, here to celebrate this occasion. Now, when we invited you here, I think we imagined that some aspect of the international monetary system would have been relatively clear as a result of the Maastricht Treaty. But I think that now we can't say that anything is clear, which makes it even more topical to have your opinions on these subjects. So Mr. Perl will talk for 1 hour or so, and then we'll have about half an hour for questions, and we very much look forward to these lectures given by Carl Otto Perl.
Thank you very much for your warm welcome. Actually, I spoke here 3 years ago, almost 3 years ago. It was a few days before the British Prime Minister resigned. And, well, it was there was no correlation, of course, between but I remember that that was a very funny lecture for some reasons which I cannot remember. Today I want to be more serious. I had to touch at that occasion also the issue of the hard écu. Maybe one or the other still remembers the hard écu. And I was rather critical about it, but to the dislike of some people in government. But nevertheless, I'm still received and still good relations. Today I will not talk about the hard écu. I want to talk about international monetary cooperation the last 20 years. But I have to say right from the beginning that I'm not an academician. I'm not a professor. I'm a businessman and banker now since 2 years. So don't expect what you would normally expect from an academic lecture at the LSE, namely a systematic analysis, but rather an eclectic and maybe somewhat sometimes anecdotal report about some of my experiences in the last 20 years. But as a compensation for this handicap, maybe you will hear it from the horse's mouth, so to speak, because I practically attended and participated in almost all important international and European decisions and conferences, negotiations on monetary issues during that time. First, in the finance ministry in Germany as a state secretary, and then since 77 as a vice president of the Bundesbank, and then since 1980 until 1991 as the president of the Bundesbank. So I, in different capacities, I have not only witnessed but also participated actively in nearly all important events relevant for international monetary decision making. Today, as I said, I will talk about my first lecture in international cooperation in the G5, later called the G7, the group of seven, the major industrialized countries, particularly the efforts to stabilize exchange rates after the breakdown of the Bretton Woods system. Tomorrow I will deal with the issue of monetary integration in Europe, which did not start with the Maastricht Treaty, nor with the EMS, but also in 1973, maybe the most important year in the post-war history of as far as monetary policy is concerned. And I think it's maybe appropriate to elaborate a little bit about the historical, the history background of some of the events and problems of today. And what you will hopefully notice is that the problems haven't changed very much over the years. I want to start with a brief description of the institutional position of the Bundesbank in the German political system and its basic philosophy, because what I'm saying is, of course, a German view, and it's my very private and personal view, and one has to understand what I'm saying by knowing a little more about the institutional role of the of the Bundesbank and of the underlying philosophy of its behavior in this process of international cooperation, both within the G7 group and in the European monetary arrangements, first the so-called SNAKE and then the EMS, the European Monetary System. The Bundesbank was established only in 1957. Its predecessor was the so-called Bank Deutscher Länder, which means the Bank of the German States, which consisted of 10, later 11, central banks, so-called central banks of the German Länder, which together with the board, the so-called Direktorium of the Bank Deutscher Länder, formed the Central Bank Council. In other words, a decentralized, we would call it in Germany, we would call it a federalistic central bank system, but I know that federalistic in this country has a slightly different meaning. So I will call it more neutral, decentralized. Very different from, let's say, the Banque de France or the Bank of England, which is a centralized system. This model, by the way, this very decentralized system of decision making was used when the Committee of EC Central Bank Governors in the 80s and the beginning of the 90s, no, in the around 1990-1991, drafted the text for a statute of a European Central Bank, which became part of the Maastricht Treaty and which is the basis for a European Central Bank system, this statute of a European Central Bank, which the governors of the central banks, under my chairmanship, if I may say that, drafted and which became, as I said, part of this treaty. Once the Bundesbank was established in 1957, the decentralized character was maintained until today. only after the unification of Germany, the principle, one state, one central bank, was slightly changed. And today Germany consists of 16 Länder, states, but only 9 central banks called Landeszentralbank, central banks of the Länder, a little bit like the Federal Reserve System in the United States. And the presidents of these Federal Reserve Banks, Landeszentralbanken, are appointed by the second chamber, not by the government, not by the parliament, but by the second chamber, by the Bundesrat, which is a parliament of the states. The president of the Bundesbank, who is at the same time chairman of the Central Bank Council and chairman of the board of the executive board of the Bundesbank, the president of the Bundesbank is, and the other members of the executive board, are appointed by the federal government. And there are both the Landeszentralbank presidents and the members of the executive board, plus the president of the Bundesbank, normally appointed for a tenure of 8 years, very long period of tenure, 8 years. By the way, there's a discussion in the United States on this issue, because the presidents of the Federal Reserve Banks are appointed by a committee of banks in the United States, and there's a discussion whether that shouldn't be changed and they should be more accountable, so to speak, to Congress or to state parliaments or whatever. So the Central Bank Council is the decision-making body of the Bundesbank. 16 people, 18 people, it depends, changed in the course of time. And it's, as I said, consists of the presidents of the state central banks plus the executive board of the Bundesbank. A very complicated system. The Central Bank Council meets normally every 2 weeks under the chairmanship of the president of the Bundesbank, but every member, including the chairman, has only one vote. Also the same, by the way, in the Federal Reserve System in the United States. The members of the Central Bank Council have different social and political, professional backgrounds. Only a few have made their career in the Bundesbank or in banking. Some are former politicians, most of them former finance ministers of the states, not of the federation. Some former civil servants, like the current president of the Bundesbank, Hans Dietmeier, or myself. I was also, before I became president, I was a civil servant in the, as I said, in the finance ministry in Bonn. And others, quite a number of the members of the council, have an academic background. The rather complicated structure of the Central Bank Council was chosen by the lawmakers in 1957 to assure the independence of the Bundesbank, which is the main reason for its unique position in the German political system and its power in international monetary policy as well. The members of the Central Bank Council are not accountable for their decisions, neither to the federal government nor to state governments or parliaments, and they are not subject to instructions by those institutions. That goes even further than the independence of the Federal Reserve System, I think. This far-reaching independence was not undisputed when the Bundesbank law was written. Adenauer, for instance, Chancellor of Germany at that time, after the war, was clearly against it and wanted the central bank closer to the government, like in most countries. But finally, the advocates of independence succeeded, among them Ludwig Erhard, the father of the German, so-called German economic miracle. And I think three reasons can mainly be mentioned. First, for this concept of an independent central bank in Germany. First, a deep suspicion of the public in a strong central government. That was in reaction to the over-centralization during the Nazi regime. And we find that this in other areas of German politics as well. Strong states, for instance, a relatively weak central government, strong federal states, 16 states with their own parliament, their own government, etc. Even their own constitutional courts in some states. Self-government of the different branches of the social security system, etc. Also a very strong regional diversification of government agencies. I think Germany, in many respects, is a country without a center. That is a big difference to this country, for instance, or France, or other countries where you have a center like London or Paris. We don't have that, and Berlin, of course, maybe it will become a center one day again, but it hasn't been for the last 45 years, even longer, almost 50 years. The second reason for independence was the prevailing, at that time at least, the prevailing economic and social theory called neoliberalism, which had been formulated by Austrian-German authors like Hayek, Eucken, Röpke, Müller-Amack, Ludwig von Mises, and others, and which had been transformed into economic policy with overwhelming success after the war by the legendary Ludwig Erhard. And sound money, to put it in a nutshell, sound money is one of the, as we call it, Rahmenbedingungen. It's hard to translate. The framework, I can translate it as framework for functioning markets and social justice. So this philosophy of stable money, etc., which plays such an enormous role, has played such an enormous role in the post-war history of German economic policy, is coming from that underlying neoliberal theories. The third reason is by far the most important one. German people had experienced twice in recent history the destruction of their currency, once during the hyperinflation after World War I, and then after World War II again. One has to be aware that in 1923, when inflation, hyperinflation reached its peak in Germany, $1 at that time was worth 4.2 trillion Reichsmark. Inflation simply destroyed the economic base of the middle class and was one of the main reasons for the failure of the Weimar Republic. By coincidence, 1923 was also the year of the Hitler putsch in Munich, the first appearance of the Nazis on the political stage. And there is, of course, a close coincidence between these two events. That's why in the 50s, Germany's lawmakers thought inflation should never happen again, and an independent central bank would be the best guarantee to assure this. Well, in this context, I cannot resist the temptation to mention, as a footnote, that the Reichsbank in 1923 was also completely independent from the government. And so what you can learn from that is that independence alone is not a safeguard against wrong theories and wrong decisions. But that was only a footnote, and I hope it will not be reported in the German press. The main task of the Bundesbank is to maintain price stability. This is at least the understanding of the Bundesbank in respect of its role And this understanding is widely accepted and strongly supported in Germany by public opinion, which is by far the strongest ally of the Bundesbank, public opinion. As Jacques Delors once said in German, he said that in German, his German is not much better than his English, but it was in that respect, it was nevertheless very well understandable, and because he said, not everybody believes in God in Germany, but everybody believes in the Bundesbank. So that may be slightly exaggerated, but in public opinion, this is something one has to really to understand. The Bundesbank is the public institution, with very few other exceptions, maybe the Constitutional Court, but it's the public institution which has the highest credibility, much more credibility than political parties or parliament or governments, etc. And that, of course, is an enormous asset and which has to be defended. And everybody, the helm of the Bundesbank is, of course, whoever it may be, very, very anxious to defend this credibility of the Bundesbank. That one has to know to understand some reactions and some behavior of the Bundesbank in very recent events, not at least here in this country. I think it's very important to understand that. With respect to price stability, the Bundesbank law is rather vague, actually. It says only the task of the Bundesbank is to safeguard the currency, die Währung zu sichern. This could, and in the understanding of the lawmakers at the time, I think it did include the external value of the currency as well as the internal value. Both are, of course, closely interrelated. In the course of time, external stability, i.e. exchange rate stability, became more and more incompatible with internal stability, i.e. price stability. Indeed, there has always been, the whole post-war period, starting in the 50s already, there has always been a major conflict between the commitment to fixed exchange rates, first in the Bretton Woods Agreement, of course, and later in other international agreements, like the Louvre Agreement, for instance, and last but not least, in the EMS, a major conflict to defend fixed exchange rates on the one hand and to maintain domestic price stability. This conflict runs like a central thread through the history of German monetary policy since the late 60s, maybe even earlier, and this is the main subject of my lecture tonight. Finally, the Bundesbank always decided in favor of domestic price stability and sacrificed exchange rate stability if necessary. There are literally hundreds of statements by Bundesbank officials, including myself when I was president of the Bundesbank, that the majority of the Central Bank Council felt responsible for price stability in Germany, but not, for instance, for a certain exchange rate of the dollar, or, as it was even suggested at some occasions, of the yen. In the Louvre Agreement, for instance, the Bundesbank was asked to defend the exchange rate of the yen by intervening in the markets, and we always refused to accept that. Of course. Finally, the Bundesbank felt not even responsible for the European monetary system, as we have seen very recently. And this position was emphasized by the new president of the Bundesbank very recently, when he said, the Bundesbank cannot be the central bank of Europe. I hope I quote him correctly. I read that only in the newspapers. But what he wanted to say, I'm sure, was that he was responsible for the price stability in Germany, He was the central bank for the Bundesbank and the central bank of Germany, and is not responsible for other currencies. So we experienced also continuity in this respect. The conflict between domestic monetary necessities and the commitment to defend a certain exchange rate is, of course, not a German speciality, but in most countries, central banks in the past had to raise interest rates and to tighten monetary policy. In other words, had to pursue a rather deflationary policy in order to defend exchange rates, regarded as unsustainable in the eyes of the currency markets. We still remember recent examples. For the Bundesbank, it was most of the time the other way around. The markets expected an appreciation of the D-mark in terms of the dollar and or European currencies. This caused an inflow of money and capital which threatened to destroy the framework of monetary discipline in Germany. I have prepared a few charts in order to illustrate this argument a little bit, and with the help of my distinguished assistant, I would like to, I'm not sure I can work with this technical high-tech instruments. So what you can see here is the nominal exchange rate of the D-mark against, in that chart, against the currencies of 18 industrial countries. This is a
an average, weighted average.
And there is the external value against the currencies of the EC countries. So you see that the D-mark has practically always been appreciated since 1973, the collapse of the Bretton Woods system, beginning of floating, against the rest of the world, but even more against European currency. In fact, the D-mark was appreciated against the dollar since 69 until today. 69 was a revaluation, and numbers are based before revaluation of the D-mark, until today by 137%, against the French franc by 180%, and by not less than 319% since 1969. 25 years, against the British pound. Of course, one reason for this development of the external value of the D-mark, but at the same time a contribution to that effect, was the much better consumer price performance in Germany than in most other industrialized countries. The average inflation in Germany since 1960 was only 3.3%. Maybe we can show that on the chart too. In fact, Germany was the only OECD country which in the 70s, after the oil crisis, the first oil price shock, has never had a double-digit inflation rate. The only OECD country. Even countries like Switzerland and Japan, with this very good inflationary record, had at some times, after the oil crisis, inflation over 20%. And I'm particularly proud, I have to say that, that inflation was below 3% for 8 years out of the 11 and a half years I was in office. Actually, when I took office in 1980, inflation was above 77%, not 70, my goodness. I'd like to blame Ottmar Emminger, who was my predecessor. By the way, he was a student of the London School of Economics, and so he was a much better economist than myself. I'm not saying he was a much better president of the Bundesbank, but he was a better economist, that's for sure. Well, and when I resigned in 1991, inflation was above 4% again, as a consequence of the of German unification. But even this 4.5% inflation in 1991 was much lower than market expectations. I want to remind you that at that time, particularly analysts in Britain, banking and analysts and other people here in this country and in other countries, America as well, predicted much higher inflation in Germany. And on balance, the record of the Bundesbank as far as inflation is concerned can be considered as being pretty good. Maybe we can show the third chart, which shows that due to the considerably lower German inflation, the real rate of exchange, the real rate of the D-mark, practically, in spite of the strong nominal appreciation over the time, numbers I mentioned, was almost unchanged against a basket of 18 currencies. That is the lower line. You could even argue that the D-mark was slightly devalued in real terms, in spite of the heavy and strong appreciation in nominal terms, which means, of course, in other words, that competitiveness of German industries, exporting industries, has not been negatively affected by the appreciation of the D-mark over the time, at least as far as the exchange rate is concerned. Maybe for other reasons it looks slightly differently. And this, of course, can be seen as a result of a very consequent anti-inflationary policy of the Bundesbank. It's obvious that exchange rate turbulences over the time haven't made monetary policy easier. And that's the last chart for the time being. That shows the chart 4, Richard, which shows the development of money supply. In fact, the Bundesbank was the first central bank in the 70s which published money supply targets. And today it's one, maybe I'm tempted to say it's one of the last central banks which still publishes money supply targets. But as this chart shows clearly, the target was most of the time missed. So it's very hard to read these lines, what it really means, and I do not want at this occasion to discuss whether money supply targets are a reliable compass. Most central banks have changed this concept in the meantime. I think at times of enormous volatility in foreign exchange markets or with events like German unification and the emergence of sophisticated new instruments in financial markets, it's hard to find any indicator, monetary indicator, of consistent liability. Therefore, I think it's fair to say that money supply figures should be used only with caution, and that other indicators should be taken into account before, should also be taken into account before decisions are made. Nevertheless, as the great Milton Friedman has said, money matters. It sounds rather trivial, but he got the Nobel Prize for that statement. And I think he is absolutely right. Money matters. If a central bank realizes that money supply figures are exploding, it should be taken as a clear signal that inflation is around the corner. There are too many examples, not at least in this country, where this signal was ignored and the results are well known. the reason why the Bundesbank very often had to defend exchange rates by intervening and sometimes even by hesitating to take decisions which the Central Bank Council considered as necessary is very simple. The independence of the Bundesbank is not unlimited. Legally, it is limited by the fact that the government, and not the Bundesbank, is finally responsible for exchange rate arrangements with other governments. Actually, when I was in the when I joined the finance ministry in 1972, I was asked by Helmut Schmidt where the legal basis for this competence was, and I said, there's no doubt there must be a law saying that, but then I recognized there was no legal basis at all for that. There was at least no law which explicitly said the government is responsible for exchange rates. But it was never really disputed in Germany, not even by the Bundesbank. And legally it did follow from the Bretton Woods Treaty, which was of course an internationally agreed treaty amongst governments and not amongst central banks. This rule that governments were responsible for exchange rate changes was adopted when the EMS was founded, in spite of the fact that the EMS is based on an agreement amongst central banks, especially the intervention obligations, the credit facilities, and the settlement procedures. During the negotiations at the so-called Baar-Niebuhr Agreement in 1987, I suggested, as president of the Bundesbank at that time, that the decisions to change exchange rates, decisions for realignments in the EMS, should be put in the hands of the Committee of EC Central Bank Governors in order to depoliticize these decisions and to allow the system more flexibility. But this suggestion was, like many others, bluntly rejected by all governments, including the German government, I have to say, which I think is very regrettable, because it has become obvious during the last 12 months or 15 months that governments are very often not able to agree on a convincing realignment of exchange rates in due time. The last time we have seen that, as I said, was last year. This has been certainly one of the reasons for the de facto collapse of the European monetary system. And one should not blame unknown or even known speculators, but those who are responsible, and the governments have been responsible and are responsible for exchange rate changes according to the rules of the European monetary system. The Bundesbank, I assume, is much happier living in a de facto floating system with practically no intervention obligations for the time being, instead of a system of, quote, fixed but adjustable, unquote, exchange rates, which Alan Walters accurately, I think, once called half-baked, because adjustments never take place at the right moments in such systems, as we have seen during the Bretton Woods system and later, even more dramatic maybe, in the EMS. I will talk about the EMS and the problems of a monetary union in Europe in my second lecture tomorrow. Today I want to use the time to elaborate on international operation, cooperation in terms of monetary policy during the last 20 years. Maybe it's a little nostalgic or so, but you will certainly forgive me for that. Actually, when I became state secretary, as we call it in our system, for national and international monetary policy in the German finance ministry in 1972, Helmut Schmidt was finance minister in Germany, and the finance minister in France at the time was Valéry Giscard d'Estaing, and in the United States, George Shultz. Very distinguished group of finance ministers. still known, three of them, what you cannot say about all finance ministers in all countries. In my view, this is not without relevance. That's why I'm mentioning the names, because I wonder what would have happened to the world during that turbulent times without the strong leadership and cooperation of these three people in particular. Remember, it was the time of the Bretton Woods, of the collapse of the Bretton Woods system, the system of fixed exchange rates, and it was also the time, 1974, of the first oil price. 1973 was the beginning of both the G5, later G7, cooperation and the attempt to create a European monetary system with fixed but adjustable exchange rates. Talk about that tomorrow. Actually, if you allow me this little anecdote, G5 was casually founded in May 73. On the Sunday afternoon when George Schulz had invited Giscard d'Estaing, Helmut Schmidt, and Tony Barber, the British Chancellor at the time, for an informal talk in the library of the White House, and the meeting was also attended by Paul Volcker, who became well known later, by the way also a student of the London School of Economics. And he was Undersecretary for Monetary Affairs in the United States at that time, and Claude Pierre Brossolette, the Directeur General, the predecessor of Jacques Delarosière, by the way, in the French Trésor, and Derek Mitchell, British Permanent Secretary for Monetary Affairs, whom some here still remember, certainly, and myself. So, and the dust of the currency crisis, of the Bretton Woods collapse had just settled, and the tone of the discussion had become less confrontational. In fact, these men hadn't known each other before, strange enough, but they began to like each other, and at least they recognized that the Western world was in a deep crisis. Even the possibility of an oil crisis was already mentioned in May 73, in that meeting in the afternoon, and their leadership was very important. So finally, the so-called library group was established, and later we invited also the Japanese to join, and then it became a G5, and then later even the central bank governors were invited on the strong insistence of Arthur Burns and Karl Claassen. And so since then, the cooperation amongst finance ministers and the central bankers had their own club in Basel already before, but this so-called G5 cooperation began. It was not an effort to stabilize exchange rates. There were other groups, the so-called G20 under the chairmanship of Jeremy Morse, who worked in the framework of the IMF on that without any result, as we know. But this group was by far the most important, is still, I think, maybe the most important institution in as far as international economic and monetary policy is concerned. So I don't want to go too much into history because time is running. I'm tempted, of course, to talk more about that, the beginnings of that in 1968, in 1971, when Germany for the first time started to float the D-mark, widely forgotten, this event. It was a lonely decision by Karl Schiller at the time, and even the German Chancellor didn't know about it. It was really a lonely decision, and it led to a deep crisis between the United States and Germany, and within Europe. Schiller, who was really a great economic minister in Germany, after Ludwig Erhard, certainly the man I admire most, and who brought me into politics, into this business, so to speak, but he was not really a great communicator. He liked this lonely decisions, and the result was really a freezing of international relations at the time. And then we had, in August 71, the decision of the American president to close the gold window, which meant that the United States did no longer honor their commitment in the Bretton Woods agreement to change every dollar which was presented to them into gold. The French had taken advantage of that to a large extent. The Germany, because we were much more dependent on the American political support, at one point did not present our dollars, and so we have more dollars and the French have more gold. In the meantime, I don't know what the better investment is, because we got some interest on our dollars and they got no interest on their gold. Nevertheless, that was the time when German, the D-mark, became by accident, so to speak, a reserve currency. Within a few months in 1971, our currency reserves went up from 20 billion D-marks to almost 70 billion. A reserve currency was really born within 3 months' time. And against our will and against our intention, it was the result of the weakness of the dollar. There was an attempt in December 1971 at the Smithsonian Agreement to go back to fixed exchange rates again, and President Nixon called it the most important event in monetary history, but it didn't last very long. After 3 months it was finished, and in 73, all currencies were floated. The majority of the Bundesbank Council, I think, was not really unhappy with that collapse of the fixed exchange rate system, because except the president, Karl Claassen, at that time, he was a very strong advocate of fixed exchange rates. He was a banker, you know, and big business and the banks in Germany at that time were very much against floating, against flexible exchange rates, etc., because they thought that would lead to chaos and so on. We had even an election campaign on that issue for some time. So, but the Bundesbank, I think, was quite happy, the majority at least of the Central Bank Council, because as a consequence of this heavy inflows of hot money at the time, inflation was up to 7%, which was absolutely unacceptable and without precedence in Germany at that time. And the money supply increased, which was not published yet at that time, but still already noticed, of course. The money supply increased between December 72 and March 73, within a few months, by 28%. And of course, that was potentially at least inflationary, no doubt. So time is running and I cannot go in all the I think very fascinating history of the 70s, because we can learn a lot about our time. There was very turbulent times in the exchange markets, but I only want to refer to the dollar crisis in 78, 79, which some of you will still remember. The dollar was really in a free fall at that time, and as on the other side, what were always the D-mark? That was the dollar had to be expressed, the value of the dollar in something, in gold, but gold was gone. Gold price also went up strongly. At the peak, it was $850 an ounce. Today, it's 370, something like that. But in terms of currencies, it was the D-mark, which was the alternative which was regarded by the markets as an alternative to the dollar. And so the result of this development was, of course, a very strong increase in liquidity, money, and the instruments of the Bundesbank at that time were not as well developed as they are today to neutralize at least the liquidity effects of this capital inflows. So it was really a threat to price stability. There was this so-called locomotive theory at the bond summit in 78, et cetera, et cetera. But finally, the dollar crisis peaked in September 78 at the occasion of the IMF meeting in Belgrade. And I still remember that very well because Ottmar Emminger and myself, he was my predecessor, but I was already nominated as his successor. We talked with Paul Volcker and the American finance minister, whose name I really have forgotten. I think it was Bill Miller. It's a name you can forget, I mean. Bill Miller. They tried to persuade us, including the German government and Helmut Schmidt, who was always interested, he was chancellor at that time, of course, interested in monetary things, to intervene and to stabilize and to support the dollar. And we had a special bilateral meeting in Hamburg before the Belgrade meeting, and we bluntly refused and said, no, we are not ready to do that except you change your underlying policies. So, and it became really a deep crisis, a dramatic crisis. And so Paul Volcker left the IMF meeting in Belgrade before the end, went home, and did the only thing which was promising a change, and which we some of us do remember, he raised interest rates dramatically. You know, at some time, the prime rate of the American banks went up to more than 20%. At the beginning of the 80s. It was really a dramatic change in policy, and it changed the world, one can say. And it was the last moment to do that, because otherwise inflation, which was already rising dramatically, would have become uncontrollable. Because on top of all that, we got the second oil price increase in 1980 or when it was. So when Ronald Reagan became president of the United States, a new team took over in the U.S. Treasury. Donald Regan and Beryl Sprinkle convinced Friedman Knight from the Chicago School. And so for years, there were no interventions in the exchange rates anymore and no efforts to stabilize the exchange rate of the dollar. The American administration bluntly said no, they didn't want to do that. The Bundesbank was a little more pragmatic. We said that interventions should not entirely be excluded from the box of instruments of monetary policy, but we agreed with the US Treasury that external monetary stability could at the end only be achieved by domestic monetary discipline. In other words, that each country was responsible to put its own house in order. And it doesn't mean, actually, that international cooperation in financial matters didn't exist at that time. On the contrary, there was a very close cooperation, very efficient, when the debt crisis began in 1982, the debt crisis of Latin America, the developing countries. And the financial system of the world really was under threat. But that cooperation took place not amongst governments, but mainly amongst central banks in Basel at the BIS. And the president of the Swiss National Bank, Fritz Leutwiler, at that time, he played a crucial role together with Volcker and Delarosière, who were the managing director of the IMF, is now the, as you know, the new boss of the EBRD here in London. By the way, also the Arabs, the Saudis in particular, contributed a lot to provide all these bridging credits and all these kind of things in a very flexible and efficient way, but without any publicity. And the IMF, which was still looking for a new role after the breakdown of the Bretton Woods system, became the center of international cooperation at that time. And the IMF, as you know, was actually founded, and one of the founding fathers was Lionel Robbins, as we know, to provide short-term credits, balance of payment credit, mainly for industrialized countries. That was the original idea in the Bretton Woods context of the role of the IMF. But in a system of floating exchange rates, there was by definition no need for this kind of support anymore, and so the IMF was in a situation to losing its role, actually. Britain in 1976, by the way, was an exception because of the special situation of sterling as a reserve currency. And Britain was, I think, the last major industrialized country which got an IMF credit, conditional under strict conditions. So the IMF took up this challenge with the debt crisis and really organized support for developing countries and got a new role, and I think a very useful and fruitful role in that context. Well, to mention the last, the last episode, so to speak, is the Plaza and Louvre experience. One has to remember, and maybe Richard, you could put on the chart 6 to demonstrate that after the change in the American administration, six, please. United States really enjoyed a very strong renaissance, so to speak, under Reagan and with this tight monetary policy under Volcker. And the result was an enormous increase in the value of the dollar. It's expressed here in D-mark dollars, so you have to, it's the other way around, so to speak. You know, that was the
first revaluation of the D-mark, then you have the collapse of the Bretton Woods system, dollar crisis, and that is the upward movement of the dollar, which went up to 3 mark 47, I remember, was the peak from 180 or something like that. It almost doubled in value against the D-mark. And of course, the Bundesbank was not very happy about that. The Americans didn't do anything. They, as usual, I mean, they had this benign neglect. As the American finance minister, Jim Connolly, once said in the 70s, he said, well, it's our currency, but it's your problem. So it hasn't changed very much since then, I tell you. So, but we became a little anxious about the competitiveness of German exporters with a dollar D-mark rate of 347. And the Bundesbank, I remember that day very well, we started to sell dollars, billions of dollars, within a few days without any warning and as a complete surprise for the markets. It was really a shock for the markets, and the dollar fell from 3 mark 40 to 2 mark and 80 or something. The Americans, first they protested against that, but the markets were impressed, and that what we wanted to achieve. But that was long before the Plaza meeting. The Plaza meeting, which took place in September 85, an attempt to bring the dollar down, was organized by the United States. Jim Baker and David Mulford responsible for that in particular. And the view which some of the participants expressed later in their memoirs, and so, you know, particularly here in this country, memoirs are very popular and so well received. Maybe one day I write my memoirs. No, but the view expressed in this kind of memoirs that the Plaza Accord was the beginning of a new phase of international monetary cooperation is, in my opinion, not justified by the facts. The Bundesbank was not included in the preparations of the Plaza Agreement. They were entirely left to the officials of the finance ministries of the G5, but the Bundesbank agreed to continue to sell reasonable amounts of dollars in a concerted action because we felt that this was also in our interest. But there were always tensions and misunderstandings about the character of the agreement with the US Treasury. And looking at it from hindsight, I believe the Plaza meeting was really a non-event because the dollar was already on the way down, not at least because of the increasing US budget deficits, which became more and more an issue of anxiety for the markets. Much more important, in my view, than the Plaza meeting was the Louvre meeting in 87, 2 years later. The dollar had not only as an effect of this Plaza agreements, but mainly because of market forces, had declined from 347 down to, as you can see, steep fall to almost half of its value. Enormous depreciation, an enormous, almost 50% depreciation of the dollar. So everybody was embarrassed, including the Bundesbank, I have to admit, what that would mean, this volatility in exchange markets. By the way, it's not really a very good result of this international cooperation when you see going up and going down within a few years, this heavy volatility, what that means for investors, etc. So finally, we got together in Paris. The Americans had prepared a document with very detailed rules for interventions in order to stop a further decline of the dollar. And at the end of the day, we agreed on concerted interventions. But I want to say that I myself, as the president of the Bundesbank, I was the only central bank governor who was responsible for interventions. In all other countries, including the United States, it's not the central bank which is responsible for interventions, it's the government. And it's only the Bundesbank which owns the currency reserves in the German system and which is responsible for intervention. So I declared at the end that in my understanding, this could not be interpreted as an agreement on target zones or ranges. On the contrary, most of the finance ministers gave the impression afterwards. This statement was completely ignored by all the other participants, I have to admit. On the contrary, most of the finance ministers gave the impression that the Louvre agreement was the first step to a more rigid system of target zones defended by interventions, of course, particularly interventions by the Bundesbank. Not at least our colleagues from smaller countries like Switzerland and Holland and Denmark, etc., who were expected to participate in market operations, but got completely confusing information what had been agreed. And the discussions reached their climax at the IMF meeting in September in Washington, when, to my surprise, even the British Chancellor advocated a kind of target zone concept in his official speech, which had not been discussed before in the G7. And the French, of course, were always in favor of fixed exchange rates. So what only two or three of the G7 participants knew was the fact that the Bundesbank had already decided to tighten monetary policy, and because the Central Bank Council was very worried about inflation and thought that our monetary policy was too permissive And we didn't want to repeat the mistake we had made at the end of the 70s with respect of the exchange rate situation, when we allowed money supply figures to overshoot because we were so afraid of an appreciation of the D-mark. So when this became known after the IMF meeting, the tightening of monetary policies, very, very slight little increase in interest rates, the Secretary of State of the Treasury at that time, Secretary of the Treasury at that time, Jim Baker, made his well-known remark on U.S. television that, as I quote, that the U.S. would not accept surplus countries to raise interest rates and just sitting and there and tolerate that. And the stock markets reacted very nervously. And so, ironically, I had, together with the German finance minister, Stoltenberg, we had a very peaceful lunch with Jim Baker on the 13th of October in Frankfurt, not published, private lunch. And in the afternoon, the stock market opened in America on that Monday. The Dow Jones went down by 600 points. That was the crash of 87. And it was really, I mean, a big discussion whether that would be the beginning of a deep recession again, like in deep depression, like in 1929, etc. Fortunately, that did not happen, but practically this was the end of this kind of efforts to stabilize the dollar D-mark rate or dollar EQ rate, if you want, because it became more and more obvious that exchange rate cannot be defended against market forces. Nevertheless, I think there's a necessity for international cooperation left. It's not the end of international cooperation in monetary policy. On the contrary, what I think is necessary and what we should aim for is to try to defend exchange rates, defend exchange rates against strong market forces, but to agree on a set of principles, basic principles for monetary policy in order to achieve a higher degree of convergence of economic fundamentals, which will finally lead to much more exchange rate stability in the markets. And the G7 is certainly a good forum for that purpose. So are the gatherings of central bankers in Basel. And of course, the IMF can also play a more active role in supervising this kind of understandings, which fortunately have made some headway in the meantime. I'm strongly opposed to the creation of new institutions, as it is always suggested when problems cannot be solved. What we urgently need is an international liberal spirit in order to maintain free markets, not only for goods and services, but also for money and capital, which is so important for the allocation of investments, economic growth, and prosperity. Of course, in a highly integrated single market, which we have got in Europe, fortunately, already to a remarkable extent, the issue of exchange rate stability has got a different quality, even more so in a political framework which has the ambitious goal to lead finally to political union. But this I want to discuss in my lecture tomorrow, and I want to close here exactly 1 hour, Richard, I'm prepared to answer questions and listen to your remarks. Thank you.
Very good.
Radio.